and then I'll turn this on. And then, so I see Dr. Otto here. We're going to get him in into the stream out of the waiting room. And I do believe that we can all be heard. Let us know if you can't hear us.
I can hear you.
How's it going, doctor?
I can hear you.
Not bad. Not bad.
All right, I got an echo here.
I can hear you.
Not bad. Not bad.
Oh, see what's happening?
I can hear you.
Not bad.
Okay.
Not bad.
We gotta kill that. Where's that coming from? Hold on just one second, doc.
Okay. You all right now?
That got it. I think we got the echo. I think we got it. All right, we're live. Welcome to the Doom Depot. It's a kind of a nighttime show based around some doom metal that we play, and we kind of like having big brain guys come on the show once in a while. And when I saw when I got tagged on Twitter by Carl to that you were willing to go on any show in the world, I said I'm going to book this guy right now, and so we did. We booked you, and here you are. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, if you don't mind. You don't have to go into too much detail or, give away too much information if you're not comfortable with that. But tell us why you're willing to go on any show, and particularly on Twitter, and what is it that you specialize in?
Okay, so in 2022, my latest book, I think it's my fourth book. Was published, kind of the one I spent about 10 years on researching in total while I was teaching at various overseas universities. But it's a history of ethnic Germans in the Russian Empire and Soviet Union, with an emphasis on the years 1941 to 1955. And it's published in English language, but out of Germany, Stuttgart, Ibadan Press. But it hasn't sold as well as I would have liked, would have thought. It just had a really good review by a professor out of Finland, Petri Ahonen, in Slavic Review. But I would like to kind of get my numbers up there. Not so much that I care about the royalties, which are pretty small, but just having been kind of the focus of my research for so long, to have more people read it and be able to benefit from the knowledge in it. I don't know what the total sales are. According to WorldCat, it's in 1,056 libraries worldwide. I figure if I go on shows and talk about it, people will be more likely to go get the book, either purchase it or check it out of the library that has purchased it.
Definitely. And we're going to take a look at that, but let me bring that up real fast here. I'm playing around. We got it. We're in a new studio. This is the first time I've used it, so I'm still kind of getting used to all the controls, but I think we got, I'm trying to get us all in the same thing with the with this scene here. Let me just, that's what I want to do. And then that, yep, see, I'm perfect. I'm really good at this, as you can tell. Let me yeah, that works. So, I wanted to bring up the screen here. Let me just, a little bit technically estranged here, but so I got an academia page from you. And this has a lot of things that you've published, and then your book is actually in another place. Is it not? Let me get a link for that. Is there a chat here? Or I can just look it up by the title. What was the title of your book again?
The Years of Great Silence.
That's right.
So, and then there's a long subtitle, which was the publisher's idea, not mine, but
So we're talking about ethnic Germans in the Volga, right? Like in right during the Reich, during the Third Reich, and during the aftermath of the Third Reich, essentially.
Well, it starts in the 18th century, but it focuses mainly on the years of 41 when they are deported from the Volga and Black Sea regions and Transcaucasus and other places. They had established colonies in the 18th and 19th centuries into Siberia and northern Kazakhstan. And while it goes all the way up to the mass return migration of Aussiedler and Spät Aussiedler to the Bundesrepublik, it mostly focuses up until 1955. So at the end of 1955, the special settlement restrictions were formally repealed, and the German population of the Soviet Union was paroled, as it were. They weren't rehabilitated. So there was a partial rehabilitation later in 1964 and again in 72. The main focus is when they were under the special settlement regime. So that would have started with the mass deportations in 41 and officially ended on 13th of December of 1955.
That's a long time. That's a lot of...
it's 14 years.
Yeah, of just being of exile, just continuous exile of all Germans, right, from the region.
All the ethnic Germans that were Soviet citizens that the Soviet government could get its hands on were exiled from the areas of European USSR, west of the Urals, into Kazakhstan and Siberia. Now, there was already a population of a couple hundred thousand in those regions, so they're obviously not deported because they're already there. Mm-hmm. But most of them are also put under special settlement restriction, although not until after the war with Germany ends in most cases. So you see particularly in Kazakhstan and Central Asia, special settlement restrictions are imposed upon the local German population that had migrated there starting in 1882 from the Volga and Black Sea regions. It starts in 1945 after Germany had already surrendered.
Wow. So we're talking about a lot of people displaced. And this isn't administrative. They didn't just get a letter in the mail that said you need to go, right? These were very violent.
There's no letters. The NKVD internal troops showed up and started going house to house where there were German households, and telling them they needed to pack for the journey, and started moving them into collection points at rail stations and then onto trains and moving the trains eastward. So they don't have a lot of time. The armed units of the NKVD showed up at their house and said, "You're being deported to Siberia or Kazakhstan. You have 15 minutes to grab your property, and we're putting you on this truck and taking you to the train station."
Were these people that didn't have much, or were they people that were, you know, well established?
A lot. Individually, the property wasn't so great because the communist system had been confiscating it, and the more wealthy members of the community that already been subjected to deportation to the far north in the Arctic Circle, as the Urals, Siberia, and Kazakhstan. Many had gone to labor camps already in the 1930s. Collectively, they also had a lot of property that was owned by the individual kolkhozes for things like agricultural stock in the Caucasus. This included stocks of wine and cognac, or brandy, I guess, because it's not the cognac region of France, but the same thing. It included various farm implements, horses. So there was a lot of that, but they also, you know, individually had property that was confiscated, things like in the Caucasus, oriental rugs, various, china, cutlery. It's hard to kind of calculate it all, But the estimates are that individual and collective property owned by the Germans was quite significant. It was a huge amount. They even confiscated camels. The Volga Germans were using as draft animals. So there's a huge amount of property confiscated in the deportation. And they basically go from being one of the wealthier ethnic groups, even after the dekulakization in the 1930s in the Soviet Union, to be totally impoverished and having nothing in Kazakhstan and Siberia.
Yeah, I can imagine that life was pretty very difficult and took a very bad turn over a very short length of time for them. If they'd been established there for very long, you know, had families and histories, it's a different kind of life. It's really one that we can't really imagine, I think, in modern times. Even just you know, being in a place where people could kick you out or evict you, or you know, just the fact that ethnic groups would do that. Now, I think that a lot of people that I know tend to think that could be a possibility in the future. You know, that could happen here. We would see, you know, ethnic wars or you know, battles. It just takes some sort of minor conflict to sort of kick that thing off again. Do you think that's possible? Do you think that, as a historian, when you look back, do you kind of see echoes of the same things happening, patterns being repeated?
Well, I mean, anything is possible. One thing that obviously sticks out, it's much, much easier to uproot a demographic minority than it is majority. So whites in America haven't reached a minority position yet. But obviously, in some places like South Africa and earlier Rhodesia, where they were always a minority in the 20th century, you've seen expulsions and pressure to emigrate through violence and whatnot. So it can change, but generally, if you have a demographic majority, you're still okay. It's when that tips that you start to have a problem, I think, in many of these cases. And of course, the German colonists that always been a minority coming over into the Russian Empire compared to a much larger Slavic population than, of course, in Central Asia, Turkic populations.
Now, were there the demographic pressures that drove Germans kind of to become their own diaspora and just kind of spread out all over? A lot came to America. A lot went into the steppe, I suppose you could say, or into the region.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of German emigration out of Central Europe, what becomes Germany after 1871, the Second Reich, in part because they aren't unified, they're difficult to defend themselves. So the first large migration to the Russian Empire occurs right after the Seven-Year War, where the states between Prussia and France, who are fighting Prussia on the side of the British, they're the battleground, but there's also, because they're the battleground, a lot of conscription, high taxes, and various other things that are unsavory to the population. So a lot of people in Hesse and the Palatine and Baden and Württemberg, these smaller German-speaking states, caught in the war, they decide, well, you know, there's not much left here anymore. It's been destroyed by the war, but they're offering, you know, a free land, freedom of religion, freedom from conscription, freedom from taxes over in the Russian Empire. Maybe we should try over there.
So it's, you know, it's probably just people looking for a better chance, a better life, you know, headed where they've got to go.
Right. But this occurs repeatedly because, you know, between the Seven-Year War and you have the first mass migration into the Russian Empire in 1764 and 1871, when Germany becomes a unified state, there's a lot of push factors. So the second big migration, it goes into the Black Sea region after 1804 is because of the Napoleonic Wars, where again, these small German-speaking states are caught between these larger powers in particular France to the west. They're not able to defend themselves the way they would be able to if they were a unified state earlier.
Sorry about that. I was muted. I'm trying to get the screen back up here. Didn't have any problems until right until we started to join this group thing, and then I lost kind of the screen. So I'm improvising here with a camera. There we go.
Yeah.
We're kind of doing it live here, Otto.
No problem.
So we have Carl on a lot, and you know, of course, Carl is also a historian, and you know, he's we have a lot of fun talking to him because a lot of fans of the show are fans of, you know, of Germany, especially of the Third Reich Germany. There's always parallels being drawn to today. So I think it's kind of natural for people to ask those kind of questions, but do you see parallels between today and past history where like people are making mistakes, maybe not so much people, but regimes, governments, you know, repeating the past? Do you kind of see the world through the eyes of like the communists sort of won World War II and just been this massive migration ever since then kind of into white countries? Or is that just a conspiracy theory that I think a lot of us love to kick around? I mean, there's definitely a demographic shift happening, and we know that the birth rates are very low. But overall, you know, you kind of see all this as engineered, like Kalergi plan type stuff, or is there a gag order? Can you say that kind of thing when you're involved with institutions of
academia? Just because something's a conspiracy doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong. Conspiracies happen all the time. But, I mean, there's certain parallels. Certainly the degeneracy has a lot of parallels in Weimar. Unfortunately, we don't even have the good parts of Weimar culture. There were a few decent artists and writers and other cultural figures in Weimar Germany. And I don't see we have anything at all. We just have the bad parts.
Yeah, we don't seem to have it. Like, it seemed like they had a little bit of, the Germans had a bit of their own culture left that was slipping away that they could kind of see. But it does seem that we're a little bit further beyond that. It seems like we're maybe not quite as far into the hyperinflation cycle, but you're right. The degeneracy, the immorality, all of the questionable government and just all of the things that we deal with. These are things that we've seen before. And this is why proponents of the Third Reich are so adamant about, you know, not only being very specific about the cause of the problems, but also, you know, solutions to those problems. If I could be really, really, yeah, I have to be careful what I say on this show. There's people watching. We had the ADL, we've had the ADL, the SPLC, all kinds of people say bad things about us and mean things that were just completely unwarranted.
The other thing is the birth rate thing seemed to be new. So the very low fertility rate. So during the actual years of Great Silence, the 14 years of being in exile, for a variety of reasons, the birth rate plummeted. But once those years were gone, there's like a huge increase above normal in the fertility rate. There's a deliberate attempt to kind of repopulate after having lost almost 250,000 people by the ethnic Germans in the Soviet Union. So their population between 1953 and 1956 goes from 1.3 million to 1.6 million.
You know, part of the thing that kind of got me into doing streams and shows was in some propaganda work, and I turned a couple of books into audio books, and that sort of became a thing that I, you know, kind of continued to do. And so over the last couple of years, we've managed to audio book almost a couple of dozen books. But in the course of doing that work, you kind of read them, you know. And I think when I started out doing this, I really didn't have any kind of appreciation or understanding or awareness of our own ancestors. You know, a lot of things in America we're Germanic families, Germanic stock. And obviously the war was horrible, but in the entire time after the war, leading up to the war, there was a lot of, I mean, there were a lot more people killed after the war than there were during the wars. And a lot of those people were just like women, children, displaced people that were not just in Russia, but all across Europe were kind of exiled, and Germans were sort of demonized. It's a heavy price to pay, you know, but even that was also kind of pushed by the same group of people, by these same Jews that, you know, that wrote what Kaufman wrote about Germany Must Perish, I think it was. And you had the Morgenthau Plan that kind of went into effect after the war. But it was sort of a time of silence all around Europe during that time. But there was nothing. It's still a silent. Like what gives so much power to a small group of people that can make a whole nation of people just kind of forget what happened or not talk about it even 100 years later? You know, were things? I mean, I think a lot of people believe that certain parts of the official narrative of the war were overblown, you know, and the Holocaust comes to mind, but certain things on the radio or, you know, on the internet these days without getting in trouble. You know what I mean?
Why among the Russland Deutsche, including the descendants who came over to the U.S. In the late 19th and early 20th century, and why my title of my book, why the word silence, right?
Yes.
Keeps coming up. It's the veil is still there in many ways. It's not just that we uprooted you and stole all your property and dispersed you across the steppes of Siberia and Kazakhstan, where large numbers of you died horrible deaths. Now we're going to make you shut up about it forever. Kind of like the insult to rub the salt in the wound. And it's a repeating, trope or I guess if you wanted to use like the Zoomer term meme among the population, right? You know, we don't want to be silent about this anymore. It should be something that is finally revealed. You can't have these type of events hidden. You know, obviously, it creates a lot of anger and resentment on top of the original wrongdoing that you're not even allowed to speak about it.
Yeah, it's insult after injury, and the truth should matter, and I think it does matter to our people. It just seems that it doesn't really matter to the people, obviously, who have an interest in the truth not being told. You know, it's I have a bit of a conspiratorial mind, so. You know, forgive me for I do take a few leaps, but you know, to me they're to blame for a lot of these things, or at least for the cover up of these things. And there were so many atrocities that weren't talked about. Some of the books that we made, spoke very plainly about millions and millions of Germans that were just killed from social hatred, just hatred, right? Like they were the ones that were actually discriminated against. I mean, there's clearly parallels to what we see happening to Europeans today. And so that's kind of the commentary behind this show and a lot of other shows that I kind of, you know, work around and watch. So we come off to certain think tanks as neo-Nazis I do kind of appreciate what Hitler tried to do when Germany went westward. Did they become aware of things that Jews were doing? I kind of bring everything back to the war, but why did Hitler give the Commissar order? You know, in your opinion, what did they find? Just the way that the Germans were being treated in the East was worth.
Abandoning the rules. A very big topic in terms, but the persecution of ethnic Germans begins already in 1918 by the Bolsheviks. And of course, the first Bolshevik governments, the Politburos, are between 40 and 60% Jewish. mostly a core of Kamenev, Zinoviev, and Trotsky. The Politburo is not very big, but there is a solid Jewish bloc in there. And by 1926, at the end of 1926, 27, this ends as Stalin, and I guess you would call it Georgian bloc because there's people like Beria in there, but there's also Jews like Kaganovich and Russians like Molotov around Stalin. And then in the 30s, you have the OGPU and the NKVD dominated the top officer corps somewhere between 40 and 20% until the end of the Great Terror in November 38 when Beria comes to power, are ethnically Jewish. So you have Yagoda at the top, de facto. Menzhinsky is Polish, is de jure number one, but he's too sick really from 23 all the way to 1934 when Yagoda becomes head of the NKVD. And then you have a lot of people under them. So Belsky, number two or three man, depending upon what years you're talking about, under Yezhov in the Great Terror, 37, 38. A lot of the Republican NKVD leaders, particularly where there's attacks against diaspora groups, Ukraine, Israel Lepleski is head of the NKVD for Ukraine and for July 37 to February 38. Boris Berman is in Belarus. There's not a lot of Germans there, but certainly vicious attack of arrest and executions against ethnic Poles. And of course, Berman brother, Matvey Berman, was head of Gulag from 32 to 37. And a number two man, Kogan, and other people around them, Fearin, Frankel, who would continue to be head of the Gulag rail construction all the way up until the 46 or so. But he survives until 1960. He's not purged out ever. The head of the NKVD finance, who was crucial in organizing the finance for the mobilization of Germans into the labor army, of course, labor in 42 and 43, Lazar Berenson will also be around into the post-Dalin era, but he died of natural causes. And of course, Kaganovich almost makes it to the end of the Soviet Union. He dies in his 90s, right before the Soviet Union finally collapses.
It's how it always works, right? The worst guys last the longest.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's something about, you know, if you're an evil communist, you can live forever. So some of these guys, Molotov, Kaganovich, almost outlived the Soviet Union itself. Some Asian communists, Kim, lived very long, Deng Xiaoping, Kim Il-sung. They're not all gone even after Beria removes the Jewish NKVD officers that were associated with Yagoda and Yezhov, and puts in a lot more Georgians and Armenians from Georgia, such as the Kobolov brothers, and more Russians and Ukrainians. There's still about 4% of the NKVD, which is leadership after that, which is still double their percentage. There's still only about 2% of the population in the USSR, but they had at one time through the 30s, been all the way through the end of the terror, been over 20% of the top leadership. So they were quite visible. People like Lepleski at the very top in Ukraine, where you had 18,000 ethnic Germans executed during the German operation for being German. This was well known. I mean, there are people like Steinacher in the NSDAP and Erfurt who were writing about the famine in the Volga German ASSR in 1933 that killed like 120,000 Germans just in the Volga region.
Man, the numbers are incomprehensible. Especially if it's not, like a massive hot war, you know, where two sides are just throwing guys at each other. You know, those kind of numbers just for civilian deaths or just, you know, people that live there. You couldn't even call them migrants. They were there for...
They use the word colonists, actually.
Colonists.
They established colonies at the behest of the Russian government starting under Catherine II or Catherine the Great, who herself was from Germany, converted from Lutheranism to the Russian Orthodox Church to marry Peter III. But after Peter III is killed, she becomes the ruling monarch. And one of the things she does is bring in the settlers. He doesn't specifically look for Germans. The original manifesto from December 1762 makes it open to all Christian foreigners. So basically, any Christian European can come settle. And there are some that come from France and Scandinavia and the Balkans. But a lot of them that weren't German, the overwhelming majority are German, become Germanized, particularly if they're already close. So it was the Swedes and the Dutch. Mm-hmm. And they tend to become assimilated into the larger German population.
That sort of makes sense. And, you know, I think they've done similar things recently, too, where they offered, you know, just large groups of certain ethnicities to come live in Russia, you know, and just come make a life here. Life is easier kind of pitch. But I'm sure it's not exactly the same thing, but there's always parallels in my mind. There's always a bell that rings. This book is this looks interesting. Now, is this a complete history, or is this just particularly about just the deportation?
It covers basically from 1763 with the Second Manifesto all the way up to about 2005 or so, but. It focuses on the years 1941 and 1955. I kind of just include the other stuff as background, but the real heavy archival and interview with survivors I did in Kyrgyzstan, information, that's all focused on the World War II era from the time of the deportations, which start in 15th of August 1941 from Crimea, and in 3rd of September 1941 from the Volga region, all the way up, as I said, to 13th of December 1955. So this 14 years, which is known as the years of great silence, because these are the years they couldn't talk about, is the main focus of the book. I do include the background information and what happened later, kind of to put it into context, but a lot more could have been written about the Tsarist era and the Soviet era before the 41 deportations and, of course, the struggle for rehabilitation that occurred after Stalin's death. And the partial rehabilitation and easing up of restrictions, although there was never really an end to discrimination under the Soviets. And some of the post-Soviet states, particularly in Central Asia, that discrimination continued after the collapse of the USSR.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting why it's almost like it's not something you can really turn off, I suppose, once it's been ingrained in people, you know, over so long a time. But we're talking about a nightmare kind of thing that happened during the years that Stalin was alive for these people, you know, for millions of people, which is, it was hellish. So that's kind of crazy. And these people, they're sort of forgotten today. I hate to say, I mean, this is not a group of people that you hear much about, but I suppose at the time, this was probably a great concern to the Führer, right? Like there were Germans that were essentially all over, you know, all over Eastern Europe that were unable.
There are some places where it is talked about. So, I mean, if you go to places like Lincoln, Nebraska, where a very large percentage of the population are descended of Volga Germans, or places in North Dakota, Vichik.
So there are kind of Fargo,
a very large population descended of Germans from the Black Sea region. And they now are aware of it. But when I first started doing this in the 1990s, they weren't. So there's been a huge learning curve in the last 35 years, where the diaspora in the United States and even more so in Canada and Argentina have become aware of this kind of black hole, the silence being lifted once the Soviet archives were opened and the survivors were returning from Kazakhstan and Siberia to Germany and were able to speak and write about what had happened.
That's a bit of a white pill. I mean, it's good to hear that, that people are not only learning things they didn't know about the past, but also embracing as part of their own history, their own culture. This is something that, Jews kind of frown upon. So it's nice to see that there's still, a desire for people to connect to that, to the truth, right? And, even if it's not our families directly, but it is good to know, too, that there are enclaves of, particular descendants of Volga Germans in America, right? So that they're, continue.
A good story, on my YouTube channel, I did a couple of interviews with Lena Wolf, who was grew up in Kazakhstan, ethnic German, Ukraine. She was actually born in Latvia. They were trying to emigrate to Germany, but she was bought over to give a talk by one of the heritage groups for Germans from Russia, United States, in South Dakota, and she was like shocked that there were millions of Americans of German Russia ancestry that came from the same villages that her ancestors and other ethnic Germans in Kazakhstan had come from in Ukraine before the 1941 deportation. So this is talked about by ethnographers of Germans from Russia, especially during the National Socialist period, but even in the Weimar period. There's kind of a web of cousins everywhere, in Argentina, in Canada, in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There's even German-speaking colonies in Chihuahua in Mexico, a little bit south of me, that came from Ukraine to Canada and then into Mexico. But those colonies in Chihuahua state, they all still speak German. And it's the German Low German that they had from the 19th century when they left to go to Ukraine. So you have kind of some of these diaspora communities in places like Argentina and Paraguay and other places have preserved the culture much better than what happened in Russia because of the deportations and years of great silence.
You got a pretty impressive list of publications here. I mean, I started scrolling through and kind of, I think it's kind of funny when people said recommended reading, when you send me in the replies, I started to kind of look at some of this and I thought these are very academic papers. Like you've become a professor in this for a reason. What is the reason? How did you end up going into this field and specializing in this group of people in this area?
Yeah, it's a long story, but in my own heritage, my great-grandfather was born in Kurest, Ukraine, which is a German colony. So he was a Volhynian German for that region. They had come there in 1864 from Posibich in Poland, which is near Wuhsh today. Then it was called Lodz by the Germans. But so these were Germans that had come to Congress Poland after 1815 but before the cutoff of migration in 1819. And then when the Polish uprising occurred in 1863, the Tsarist government confiscated large amounts of property from Polish nobles and then leased it out to the Germans in Russian-ruled Poland, who then migrated into northwestern Ukraine. But there were quite a few of them, about 175,000 in Ukraine, and in Russian Poland, some 400,000 Germans in the 1897 census. So one of the larger groups. But my family had basically been moving west from Poznan, which is now in Poland, but was part of Prussia when they got there, to moving eastward across Poland and then into Ukraine. And then my great-grandfather was conscripted during peacetime in the Tsarist army. The freedom from conscription had been abolished for German colonists in 1874. And he served 18 months and then went back to being a farmer. But then the war with Japan broke out in 1904, and they tried to mobilize him into the reserves and send him to Manchuria. And he decided he didn't want to go die in that war, and he walked out of Ukraine across Poland into West Prussia, worked as a farmhand for a year, and then took a boat from Hamburg. Was denied entry in the United States because he was a person of bad moral character for going AWOL from the Russian army.
No way.
In Canada. And so my grandfather was born in Winnipeg, which still has a large Volhynian German population. The area around Winnipeg is one of the larger diasporas of Volhynian Germans. The other one is in Brazil, around, I think, Rio do Sul. I can't read Portuguese, so
that's amazing. There's a lot in South America. Wow.
Yeah. One area of Russian-German diaspora I don't know well is Brazil, so I'm limited to what I can read in English, German, Russian, and Spanish.
Limited. He's limited.
It is. I mean, this stuff is coming out in the amount of language you surprise. So right now, one of the things I've noticed is it used to be that the only people who wrote about Germans from Russia were other Germans from Russia.
Right.
So all of the stuff that comes out in the 1990s from the former Soviet Union and Russia, Kazakhstan, particularly because those are the large population, is being written by ethnic Germans, and it's being written in Russian. But now, and there's still about 200,000 ethnic Germans in Kazakhstan, you're seeing a lot of Kazakhs, scholars writing about the German minority. And they generally will write their works in Russian and then have it done also in Kazakh. So I can't read Kazakh either, but it has become a subject of interest to people outside of the minority in the former Soviet states, Kazakhstan and Russia. So you do have ethnic Russians and ethnic Kazakhs and ethnic Kyrgyz who have written about the subject in more recent years, whereas originally the only people writing about it were the ethnic Germans themselves. Now, unfortunately, the United States is still, and Great Britain's even worse, still in a period where the only people writing about the group are those that actually have a blood tie to it. So, I mean,
right.
You look at all of the literature on Russian German in the United States, you almost always see people with German names: Pohl, Sinner, Schmaltz, Kloberdance.
That's very interesting. Someone in the audience says that you're wicked smart and smooth guest. He's pretty smooth, huh? He's got a lot of answers. I this is why I love particularly historians and professors. The bigger brains, the better, because I think they kind of give context to things, particularly things that are happening now, right? Like it's very easy to sort of see the state the world is in and get very depressed and blackpilled about that. But, a lot of times it takes somebody with a history of the past to say, this isn't the first time that we've been here, or you know, make the connections such as we did to Weimar earlier. There certainly are connections to the past, and yeah, we're not talking about that long ago, really. We're talking about a period of history that was, you know, two generations ago. People, you know, remembered this stuff.
I mean, so my great grandmother, after he got to the U.S. Mm-hmm. After the war in 1945, he received two letters written in German, but not Hochdeutsch, the old Kolonistdeutsch from the Volhynian settlements in Ukraine, from his cousins. And they were in Berlin. They had managed to get out. The Wehrmacht had evacuated almost over 200,000 Germans from the Soviet Union into the Wartegau in what is now Western Poland in 1943 and 1944. And over 200,000 of them were forcibly repatriated at the end of the war by U.S. and British back to the USSR. But of the two cousins, my great-grandfather put up a bond for one of them to migrate to the United States, the $50,000 bond, which was quite a bit at the time.
Wow. Yeah, wow, yeah.
He had to guarantee that he would not go on any benefits or welfare at the state. And if he did, it would have to be paid for by this bond my great-grandfather put up. So
what? Well, we're talking about the same country.
$5,000 of cash to buy this bond, right? So you, the other 90% of the loan, like a bail bond, basically, yeah. To make sure that his cousin didn't take any federal money, right?
I got to say, it's a little shocking. I mean, it totally makes sense, but it's a little shocking. That was the complete opposite of what we have today, huh?
Right. But the other cousin was forcibly sent back, and I have no idea what happened to him. I actually have not looked into it because I'm afraid what I would find, it would just be too horrible.
Mm.
He was sent back to the USSR, and what I know of most of the repatriates, you know, sent places like the Arctic Circle or Kazakhstan or Tajikistan, where they were forced to cultivate cotton on kolkhozes. It wasn't a very pretty fate.
Nobody wanted to go back to Russia. Yeah, even the soldiers, none of them. No, everybody wanted to try to escape with the Germans, right? Like as Russia came east or you know further west, everybody was trying to get away from them. Especially the Russian prisoners, right? Because
And the Wehrmacht deliberately evacuated to try and save them, about 300,000.
That's amazing. 300,000 is a huge
mostly
number.
Mostly from Western and Central Ukraine. And they said they were sent to what is now Western Poland, which was part of Germany. But the Americans and the British sent back two-thirds of those, over 200,000. So about 100,000 managed to avoid repatriation. And 70,000 stayed in the Bayard, West Germany. The other 30,000 went to the Western Hemisphere, mostly Canada and various places in Latin America. Paraguay was one of the recipients.
Wow. That's crazy that all those people escaped and then just to get sent back. That must have been horrifying. And I can't imagine, what a futures they met being repatriated. I love the word repatriated. Doesn't it sound great? You're going to be repatriated. Yeah, we're sending you back.
But it's kind of strange because the patriate, the word comes from pater or father, fatherland.
Right.
But these people are being sent from Germany back to the Soviet Union. But these people had only been in the Russian Empire and Soviet Union for less than 200 years. If you go back, you know, many, many centuries before that, they had been Germans in Germany. And they still retained, you know, the German language. These letters that we received weren't written in Russian. They were written in German.
Right. Now, that's very interesting. It adds more to the people that live there. You know, it's very interesting that they weren't forced to, you know, to learn to become Russian, or they weren't assimilated, I should say. I guess that wasn't really the point, right? It was just why did Russia have them come out anyway? Just to
Well, because the way the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union were set up, assimilation was never really something pressed. So right. What they had instead was kind of integration on the political and economic level. But there was never really much, particularly in the Soviet era before the Second World War, attempt to assimilate groups that were into the Russian majority, although the very slim majority, about 51%, with a 49% under Tsarist rule because of Poland and the Baltic states and Finland. Instead, you know, you had these ethnic territories set up for all of the groups, and the Germans, of course, had one in the Volga. And a bunch of small ones in Ukraine, and there was one in Georgia, and there was one in Azerbaijan, and there was one in Altai Krai in Siberia, to kind of give representation to these, what they call it, Nationalnost, it's really ethno-racial group, but they allowed them to have their own language. They wanted to try and create a Soviet culture in their own language. Stalin was convinced that the easiest way to lose the political loyalty of a group was to prohibit them from using their own native language, which they did later for the Germans. But in the 1920s, the Volga German ASSR was upgraded to an ASSR in 1924 and been established by Lenin as the labor commune in 1918. So there is a shift, but none of the larger groups were ever had their language national identification outlawed. So there was always the Ukrainian Soviet Social Republic and the Uzbek Soviet Social Republic.
That seems kind of normal, though, right? Like generally, if people go to another place or another land or, you know, just a foreign culture, they generally tend to stick together and kind of stick with their own cultures and little bitty colonies or enclaves or whatever you want to call them. But
The diaspora groups had much smaller, obviously, territories, mostly just districts, rayoni. But the Volga Germans were large enough at one time. They were at their height. 600,000 of them in the region to get an ASSR. But of course, what you see with the European diaspora groups in the 1930s is that they all become suspect of being hotbeds for spies for their homeland. Mm-hmm. So Poles and Germans and Latvians, Finns, Estonians, these are all targeted during 37 and 38 during the national operation for mass arrest and execution. And then, of course, there's the mass deportations, particularly the Germans, when the Wehrmacht invades the Soviet Union on 22nd of June 1941. It's not immediate. The mass deportation start in August and really get going in September. But this is the kind of chronology, I guess, the word that this is the why it happens when it does.
Right.
It might have happened later if the war had not broken out between Berlin and Moscow.
I think that's a point of ongoing speculation and contention, right? Because everybody wants to blame Germany. Everybody wants to blame Hitler for so much. I think he really surprised everybody, surprised the world by attacking Russia. And obviously, I think all the stories I read so far are that people loved the Germans when they, when they showed up the Germans encountered, there were some horrifying things there. Of course, anytime there's war, there are war crimes. Right. And aside from all the other really hot, conspiracy type issues, There were a lot of people that died. A lot of people died. A lot of Christians. A lot of people died in the Holodomor. A lot of people died in the area just from being displaced from really racism, right? Anti-white racism, particularly after the war, in Germany and around Germany.
There was knowledge about what was happening in the Soviet Union, particularly with regard to Germans. In the 32-33 famine, a number of letters were published in German language newspapers in the U.S. Midwest, as well as Germany, about what was happening in Ukraine, which had a very large German population, about 400,000, in 1939. I said there were activists in Germany in 1933 writing about and trying to get awareness about what was happening with the famine in the Volga-German ASSR. So it wasn't unknown, but when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union and the occupied Baltic state, they came across, you know, a lot of the prisons and torture chambers where, as the Soviets were retreating, they slaughtered the political prisoners and released the criminals. It's a kind of a bioweapon there to use against the occupying forces. Of course, a lot of Western Ukrainians and Lithuanians and Latvians and Estonians, in addition to ethnic Germans, including, the only two times that you saw Mennonite taking up arms in their entire history were in the Ukraine. First, in 1918 in World War I, against in 1919 against the anarchists under Nestor Makhna. And then during World War II, again, there's Mennonites in SS cavalry units, Halbstadt, because of what the Bolsheviks and the communists had done to them, that they figured that the limits of pacifism had been overreached.
Well, yeah, that's the part that history is under the rug, unfortunately. And that's kind of where I was steering earlier, you know, with as Hitler became more aware, as he started gathering intelligence on, you know, the Eastern Front, you know, you can see a marked change in his attitude, in his, you know, in his kind of his demeanor change. Like Hitler, it's kind of seemed like something happens during, you know, the really early 40s where he becomes like a big ball of nerves and then begins to kind of fall apart, you know, and, you know, there's of course, that's always going to be a lot of speculation and arguing between parties on, you know, Parkinson's and how far along he had, you know, he had kind of gone. And I've heard accusations that his doctor was poisoning him and, you know, all kinds of different things that were kind of in play. But you can kind of tell that he stops being the happy leader kind of after, you know, he starts learning what's going on in the East and what's happened to Germans and, you know, in other countries. And that's why I think that we never really get much on what intelligence he gathered. Of course, obviously, they're going to run across atrocious things as they move into the Soviet Union. But I just think that's part of the cover up, right? Is like all of the atrocity that happened up to that point is now can just be, you know, it can all just be rounded up and blamed on Germans and you know, as the losers of World War II, we can just basically just put everything on them. Shout out to Nick from Night Nation Review. By the way, Nick, it's a great guest to have on. You should have Otto on your show. Is it Dr. Otto? Should I say Professor Otto? What's the proper term?
I haven't been a professor since it's been almost 6 years now.
Is there a professor club that you get to join? Where, like, is there secret handshakes? Do other professors know, you know, that you're in the room? Is there some clout that comes along with? I mean, obviously, it's quite an accomplishment to be a professor. I don't mean to kind of trivialize that, but what's life like for a professor? Is it different?
Well, you know, I never taught on the university level in the United States, so. For 12 years, I lectured overseas from 2007 to 2010. I was at American University of Central Asia in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, which is a Soros-Clinton operation. One of the reasons my contract wasn't renewed after 3 years. And then I was at University of Ghana in Lagos, for 6 years, And that one I left voluntarily because the local currency, which they paid us in, kept collapsing. And I got a much, much better paying deal at American University Iraq Sulaymaniyah in the Kurdish region of Iraq, where I was at 3 years. Wow. And then the CIA operation, and that's why my contract wasn't renewed. And then I went and wrote this last book because I got locked down with my parents during COVID. And then I moved out to New Mexico after accidentally getting a job when I went back to Kyrgyzstan to renew my daughter's U.S. passport. But, 2019 would have been the last time as a professor. I would have been in Sulaymaniyah at the Kurdish region of Iraq.
Wow. Wow, that's interesting. So you kind of been around the world teaching and lecturing. It's I think that's cool. I think that's cool. And I suppose it's probably not the best as far as finding work, right? To be a historian, and particularly a very particular historian. Is it do you find it difficult to find work or to get gigs? Is the gig economy good for you?
No, well, I mean, all of academia in the U.S. has been committing suicide for a while. It's probably reached the point of not being able beyond being saved in its current form. Whether it can be rebuilt after it's uprooted, I'm not sure. But
I can't imagine what it really looks like. But I suppose it's probably pretty ugly. And there's probably penalties for saying, the wrong thing still, right? You can still be canceled. You can still be blackballed. You can still be...
Yes, obviously. Yeah. But I mean, just it almost goes deeper than that. So if you go look at advertisements for since 2020, for academic jobs, they're all like for African American history or women's history, right? And the one's history of like the Russian Empire, Soviet Union, it almost completely disappeared about 2021. And then there was a brief time they had like five openings after the Russian intervention in Ukraine.
Right.
And I applied to all five. And of course, I didn't get an interview, but I thought it was kind of funny, like who was the heads of these departments. So one of the guys who was the head of the department I was applying to, his area of research and teaching was Brazilian soccer. He literally made a career out of writing about Pele.
What? Wow.
All right. Another one, woman's career was writing biographies of French courtesans. She was writing on Parisian hookers. I mean, this is not the same.
Sounds very progressive.
Like, level of subject as, political history that somebody like me. But political history basically was uprooted and eliminated in favor of, quote unquote, social history or cultural history, where you get these things like writing about the history of Brazilian soccer or French
or French hookers. Yeah. Well, that was kind of where I was headed. I think maybe you might have sensed where I was going. But yeah, essentially, I would have thought that before DEI got you, long before, liberal, like what hyper neoliberal policy in academia got to you, I would think that you would just have been cleaned out by Jews, probably during the 80s, 70s and 80s, like shortly after.
Well, I was still in high school in the 80s.
Right.
College in the late 80s, but when I first started applying for jobs, before I got I went and got my PhDs from School of Oriental African Studies, University of London. But when I came back to the U.S. applying for university jobs, I was looking primarily because of what had happened with the intervention in Afghanistan. I thought there would be interest in the history of the Central Asian states in that had been part of the Soviet Union. So in particular, obviously, I was writing about the deported nationalities, especially the Germans, over a million had been in Kazakhstan in 1989 census. So they were 8% of the population, quite large. Mm-hmm. There was like no interest really by the establishment. The government, unlike during the beginning of the Cold War, did not put any money into studying these regions, particularly not history. And you know, when I went overseas, so American University of Central Asia is a, they said, a Soros, Hillary Clinton, and also Petraeus, the general
yeah.
could keep his dick in his pants operation. Yeah. They didn't have a history department. They didn't have a history department because the Kyrgyz regime, quote-unquote democratic regime, did not want people looking into the past. They had no problem with political science and international relations because that's just all bullshit theory. So I ended up teaching in the Department of International Comparative Politics, right? And I would try to sneak in as many history courses as possible. But in reality, nobody in power there wanted anybody to know about the past. They,
right.
And but they weren't threatened at all by political science. I mean, that's just the bullshit discipline. And the same thing when I went to Iraq. American University of Iraq, Sulaymaniyah, did not have a history department. They had a social sciences department.
Are we being culturally lobotomized at the same time, you know, kind of being castrated institutionally, right? Like they're the Long March has worked out for them, and they seem to control, you know, most of the power in administration and in, you know, in oversight of all these funds, all these schools, all these massive institutions. Is there anything, is there any way that that we can establish or have we established that, you know, a beachhead? Is there, are we onto something here with kind of alternative media, alternative programming, shows like this, you know, that they give people a little bit of insight into actual history or things that they haven't been told about, or, you know, are we having an effect on your opinion?
I don't know if I'm just extremely unlucky, which I suppose is one part of it, or I just lack the talent, but I don't seem to have done very well in any type of networking in my life. But as you, at the beginning, you asked me why I wanted to come into the show. So,
yeah.
So one of the reasons, in addition to just getting out my information, it's a network. So, I mean, obviously, I hope that this show and others I've done will lead to more shows and lead to more people having an interest in what I research and write about.
It should.
Much of it, which is available free, my smaller piece is on academia.edu, but obviously the book, because the publisher in Stuttgart wants to get money, still costs a little bit. But for an academic book, $42, or if you're in Europe, 39 euros is pretty cheap.
Actually, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And if you've got to sell books, if that helps you, then by all means, we're interested in, you know, trying to help to move books or anything else. You know, we're I kind of believe in, you know, kind of establishing and keeping a community at least of people that are willing to talk to each other. They don't even have to be like-minded. They don't all have to have the same religion. But basically, we have to kind of have an appreciation for the truth, and we have to, you know, be willing to sit down and you know, in a lot of cases, stuff online is a little bit more anonymous. But guys like you, you're out there, you're certified, credentialed. I see you guys slugging it out in the trenches on Twitter every day. Yeah, you know, kind of out there defending people that can't speak for themselves. I personally think that's a really big deal. I'm a really big fan of people that do that. I think that's a courage, you know, and bravery to do something like that, because there's nothing in it for you, right? There's nothing in it for you to have to fight with Jews all day, just in, you know, even when you're right, ultimately just to be called an anti-Semite and get shadowed for a month at a time. You know, there's no satisfaction in winning one, I suppose, you know, online. But as a professor, you're kind of in the battle for minds, right? Or, you know, you have to believe in it to a certain degree that it's worth teaching people the truth and that it's worth learning, right? You wouldn't have gone to all that trouble yourself.
Yeah, I mean, in some way, I suppose, at least in a kind of a mental sense, that was probably more beneficial in some ways for me to not have been teaching in the U.S., but to have been in the former second and third world, because I got exposed to those places and got to get some firsthand knowledge. In one sense, a lot of, I think, Americans, even more so Europeans, they have the, what the Chinese call looking at flowers while on a train, right? It's all blur because they go to a country for just a week or so. Whereas I lived in former Soviet Central Asia for 3 years. I lived in Sub-Saharan Africa for 6 years. I lived in the Middle East and Iraqi Kurdistan for 3 years. If you go to those places on tour, you know, you're not going to see any problems. You're not going to see the dysfunction. But if you live there for 3 to 6 years, it becomes quite obvious the deep problems in these places. So in that sense, that's the type of learning that can't be garnered any other way. It's kind of irreplaceable type of research.
Yes. The lived experience, right? It's very Gnostic way of looking. Yeah. It's one you can't really deny, right? After you've been there for a while. Well, I think that's interesting, and I think that there's always something more to be learned, and I always enjoy learning things from people, especially sort of in these circles. There's a tendency to hear the same theories quite a bit. You hear a lot of the same things said over and over. I'm sure you've personally probably had to argue the same points time and time again. I'm sure that sometimes it can feel like, you know, there's no such thing as progress, but the fact that we're still able to talk about these things and to correct people on stuff, I think that's something to be hopeful about, and a good reason to continue, you know, trying to tell the truth about things, not just historically, but also, you know, what's happening now, and you know, keeping people honest about.
Well, that's true. I mean, is there need to be as much as possible resistance to the silence? As I say, that's it's kind of the meme, but it's also the kind of the great resentment. When you look at the Ruthland Deutsche, you know, more so than even the genocide itself, that it was a kind of this gag order from the Soviet government that was imposed, and I would argue, as I know my reviewer of Dr. Ahonen disagreed, but I would argue that in the United States and Great Britain, the English-speaking world, there's still kind of we're still in the years of great silence regarding this topic. When you compare it to what's written in Russian or German or even Spanish, we're way behind.
Okay, so you've skirted around, I think, some inside information that I've been aware of. I'm not trying to spoil anything anybody's working on, and I try not to disclose anything that people, I'm trying to be ethical here, but I know that you had to be doing some translation work for a mutual friend of a newspaper called Znamia in 1907, and that you were going to be, I've heard potentially you're going to be doing some translation work from some old Russian into English. And that's a project I'm very, very interested in because I wanted to audiobook your work product on that. You know, if everything lined up correctly.
I started on that because I have some other stuff before that. But yeah,
is that something you can talk about?
That it is the original Russian version of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which has not been translated into English.
I went down a rabbit hole one night after I think I read Carl's article where he talks about the origins of the protocols, and I had audio booked, I think probably the 1921 version, and I did a very, you know, low effort job as a propagandist and kind of a memester. I don't really put a lot of polish on anything. I wouldn't say I'd get anything reviewed, but I did a really poor rendition of the protocols, and so I wanted to remake it. And so I started to look, you know, of course, I want to I want to find the original, right? And I didn't realize what I was walking into on that, you know, because the big controversy about them obviously is where they came from. And I think it's amazing that people have traced them back so far as to 1907, you know, I guess it wasn't such a small paper, but it was, you know, these were just articles in a paper at one point. But they make their appearance and reappearance throughout history around some interesting people. And I kind of wonder, I think we all kind of wonder, you know, some of the big questions like, you know, did Hitler know about the protocols? Did Henry Ford, you know about the protocols? I mean, they all mention them, but what role did it have on their, you know, views?
A lot of the emigres from the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union did know Russian. I mean, Rosenberg certainly knew Russian very well, and he was a fairly high ranking. As Georg Leibbrandt, who was an ethnic German from Ukraine, was closely associated with Rosenberg. And there's others. The Minister of Agriculture was also in the SS. Bakke was an ethnic German from Georgia. So there is a number of the NDS, the National Socialists, that were from Russia and the Soviet Union. During the Civil War period, about 120,000 came over to Germany, about 60,000 stayed. And a number of those were prominent scholars like Leibbrandt and Stumpf. But the number were prominent in the SS, Bakke. There was one from Azerbaijan. It was in the Einsatzgruppe, and I can't remember his name, but I think Vailer. But he's interesting in that he organized a revenge killing against an ethnic German in Ukraine who had come from North Dakota. It was a Black Sea German who returned to support the communists and was involved in de-kulakization as part of the Committee of the Poor. And supposedly when SS, the Einsatzgruppe, hanged him, all of the women whose husbands had been arrested by him in the earlier, in the 30s, or in part by him, came out to cheer the execution.
Yeah. Yeah, he ruined their lives, I'm sure, right? Threw their husbands in jail or worse. So I just think it's interesting. You mentioned that these protocols, they had not been the 1907 version have not been translated before.
That's my understanding. I'm not an expert on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm basically doing this to translate the language from Russian to English. I do not have any type of specialized knowledge on the origins and the, as it were, history of this the work, the elder protocols of the Elders of Zion. It's not my area of specialty. I will probably know a lot more once I start translating it, at least know the contents of the original document.
Yeah, you're going to be in a very unique position to be able to answer some questions, I think, that nobody's ever really been able to answer. And I think that's interesting. I think that's personally, I'm a kind of a protocols conspiracy theorist. So I was just so excited to hear. I didn't even know that the 1907 documents existed. Of course, you know, my own deep searching didn't really turn up much, but I can't say I'm really a professional.
I didn't know it either, but again, I haven't, as I said, it's not an area I've done much research on at all. So, it doesn't surprise me. I think we'll all know more once I finish the project, but I haven't started at this point because I have had other things. But yeah, my understanding is that is the original protocols. And it does not exist in an English translation yet.
That's the general consensus that I get as well, is that it's the first iteration of a published protocols. And that there were a lot of alleged changes between that document and the one that actually is available, I think from 08 or 09, shortly thereafter. But I'll just keep quiet about it because I don't want to, spoil any research. And I'm really interested if you're someone that's not really into kind of the conspiracy of them or just not that big a deal, then you're the best person to kind of do that kind of research and translation.
As far as my professional research, haven't done much into esoterica at all. It's extraordinarily difficult to even get any type of traction doing the type of political history I do on Germans from Russia.
Right.
The book been out since 2022. It was published by Ibidem in Stuttgart. It was only in, I think, November last year that Slavic Review did the first academic review of it. And it came out just a couple of days ago on the web, maybe publicly accessed. And interestingly enough, of course, the reviewer is not American. He's from Finland, which is a country that was an associated power with the Axis, but also the Finnish diaspora had a very similar history to the German diaspora in terms of being persecuted by the Soviet government and being forcibly deported during the Second World War and mobilized for forced labor in the Tudovaya Armia or Labor Army. It's, as I say, in the Anglosphere, we still have, at least for academics and popular history, a veil of silence on a lot of the history of the mid-20th century, from the period of time of 1917 to into the 1950s. It makes us behind. I'm living in an area that got a large Spanish-speaking population, but I always get occasionally contacted by scholars from Spain or Chile or Mexico, and it seemed to me that on this issue, they're way ahead of the U.S. and Great Britain.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, especially now, in. It'll just be interesting to see what comes of the work. I'm definitely in Carl's ear constantly about that project. But hopefully you'll get a chance to actually do that. That I think that's neat. You'll actually get to do something that as far as I know, has not been done. You know, it's pretty uncommon to get to do a first of something. So enjoy that. It could end up being very controversial in the future. Is there anything, and obviously controversy is not good for your career as an academic, if you're trying to be an academic and remain one, if you're trying to work
I haven't been in academia for 6 years now.
If it hasn't benefited you much at the same time, though, it sounds like, it's obviously there's old boys clubs everywhere and you know, you're certain groups of people will never be at the top. There is a sort of a class system in place and I think that most of us aren't very high on the ladder on that. But I still think we're the most powerful group of people. We're just we're not very well collectivized or organized, but we kind of have a history of doing that.
That doesn't make you powerful.
Right. Well, true. What's your take on that? Do you have any interest in politics of today's politics, the Washington drama that's always going on?
Or not particularly. Between my day job and trying to take care of various other things coming, like I got to do my taxes on Monday. I don't have a whole lot of energy for contemporary politics, but
no, I can totally understand. It's a little bit of a. It's a little bit of a bitter pill to even have to talk in like political language with other people anymore. I think most of us just buy ammunition and keep a black mask in the closet. I'm not really sure what everybody does.
Well, I don't do that, but
kind of a stereotype.
I'm in a kind of a weird situation in that I have the opposite protection that rich people have. I'm so poor that there's nothing that worse that can be done to me. I could just say whatever I want.
Right. There's nothing to lose. I got you there.
Yeah, that's correct. And there's nothing left to lose. Although I am on the first floor, there's no second floor of my building, because when I was in Iraq, the day before I left and the day before this guy was supposed to left, the guy on the eighth floor of my building mysteriously fell to his death.
Oh, my.
An American of Korean ancestry, a Peter Choi. I'm not sure what he knew, but the falling thing was bullshit because, first of all, there was the toxicology report came back negative, but the balconies were quite high. They're like up to chest level. So I'm not sure how you would accidentally fall off of it.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like an actual accident. I'm sure it happens all the time.
I knew so little, I guess they were just content to let me go.
He's an author. He's already signed up for a life of suffering. Now, you know, I tried to tell Carl, I said, you know, I think more people, especially, you know, knowledgeable people should do kind of what I do, which is not the most entertaining stuff in the world. I mean, we try to be, but really, I think most at the heart of what most of the streaming community does is they want people to know the truth too. You know, and maybe not everybody's dedicated shows to telling the truth about things, or you know, they've had to find ways to sustain, or you know, gimmicks to kind of make a place in the market. But I think more people that are actually qualified, you know, with actual knowledge should be, you know, should have kind of a microphone, but a lot of them aren't really technical people. A lot of them aren't really, maybe they're, you know, kind of introverts. Some of them, I mean, I figure professors lecture people all over the world all the time. So doing a show or something wouldn't be that far departed from what what you're kind of used to. But I think that there is a market for people that want to know, you know, history. Maybe not everybody's into it. It's, you know, it's probably a boring show for some people, but there are people out there that want to know what you know. And then there are people want to know, like when David Duke goes on somebody's show, there's people that want to hear what he's got to say still. And there's, you know, there still is a crowd of listeners out there for people that talk. I try to encourage people to kind of do like podcasts or make videos or things like that. Have you ever considered doing that sort of work?
I had a YouTube channel for many years. I started when I was in Iraqi Kurdistan, and I continued it when I was locked down in California with my parents, and including when I wrote The Years of Great Silence. But I have discontinued it largely because I never got any type of audience, and it was quite a bit of work to do research and prepare for a weekly show.
Yeah. It's definitely, it can be an undertaking. Particularly the production, if you're into producing content, it's a bit of a grind, but, you know, I think that's why a lot of people just kind of do review. A lot of people are just commentary and review. You would actually have a considerable amount of it, I think, to share with people though. And the fact that you are also an author, you know, it's usually mutually beneficial for everybody. But I think this is fantastic, and I'm probably gonna pick this book up just because I'm a fan of books, and I won't audiobook it without your permission. But I might ask about that sometime, like if kind of an amateur. It's
controlled by Ibradin Verlag, and I think their main operation is Stuttgart, but I think for business questions, they have their office is actually based in Hanover. I don't know why they have the split between the two cities, but I know that I had to do correspondence with different ones depending upon what the questions were. But they would be the ones who have the legal rights for the copyright.
Okay, that's cool. It's good to know, and it can never hurt to ask, right? And then
they have a website in both English and German.
Mm-hmm.
that has their contact information. So you can write to them in either language. Though I will say one of the problems, of course, for academic publishing is that none of the academic publishers I've had, three, McFarland in North Carolina, Greenwood in Westport, Connecticut, and this one now, Ibid in Berlin, they're not very good at publicizing the books. You know, their marketing is quite limited. They don't seem to be intent on getting more than just enough sales to cover their expenses.
Yeah, I can imagine that's probably the case. Probably the case in a lot of places. You do have to do quite a bit of your own hustling, huh? And just pitch books all over the place. I mean, I wouldn't be ashamed of it. Of course, I do that on this show all the time, don't I, guys? But you have to, I mean, if you're not motivated, I don't think they're, like, the publisher won't be. So it's almost like you have to do all your own marketing. At least we're kind of in that, I'm in that edge of the internet where you're not going to get, you're just going to get banned or silenced or, you know, shadow banned, suppressed, algorithmed out of the conversation for the most part. But a lot of people I do see have to hit the bricks and move stuff around on their own. So, but I think that we should all help each other. I think that we should all, you know, help each other recommend stuff that we've read or that we, you know, that we know people for shows, people for, you know, all kinds of different things. We should have like a little in-group preference and start practicing as a community, referring the community to other members of the community for stuff. And so I think that you could definitely should do some more shows, you know, if that's of your interest, if this experience wasn't too horrible or painful. Yeah, we would certainly have you back anytime. I always kind of try to bring whatever you're into. I try to kind of bring it into the conversation for, you know, kind of make it relatable to everybody. But sometimes it's more of a challenge and sometimes it's not. I do think generally people have an interest in, especially Germans, I think people have an interest in, you know, potentially their own ancestry and their own history and their own, you know, culture and the stories of all those people. So I know that I appreciate it. I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but I'm a big fan of the history, of the historians of history.
Well, one of the problems, so there, as I said, there are millions of Americans of German from Russia ancestry, but when you go to like their heritage, organization. So I went to the 50th anniversary American Historical Society of Germans from Russia. They were paid for my flight from Iraq, and they put me up in a nice hotel where they were having the conference and paid for all my food, right? But I was, how old was I? I was in my late 40s. So it was 2009. I was 49 almost. I was 48. 48. I was the youngest person there at age 48.
Wow.
Well, my second youngest, Andy Nowicki, showed up to see me speak. But, right, we were the youngest people there. Most people were in their 70s and 80s. I asked some people, you know, where are the younger people? And they said, well, they're all working and have families. Well, I mean, I suppose that's, that's as far as it goes. But these organizations haven't been able to, as it were, get the generation after the boomers, you know, to show up to, you know, the major events. This was the 50th anniversary of the largest organization, and they literally couldn't get, you know, more than a handful of people that were, you know, younger than their mid-40s. I think there was one woman in her 30s from Texas came with her children. I thought that was great, but she was like the only one. You know, everybody else was my parents' age.
It's kind of alarming, huh? Like there's definitely a massive kind of disconnect from our history, from our past. Everybody that's kind of Jew woke or kind of Jew aware understands, I think, you know, that there's an effort for that to be the case. But, you know, what's the best way to fight this? Like, families are, we've talked already about demographics, birth rates, things like that. Like, some people just say like, just you have many babies, as many babies as possible. It's the only thing you can really do. But there's a cultural rot, right? There is a disconnect from our past. I don't want to say fatal, but maybe it is.
I taught middle school here in New Mexico for 7 months. Mm-hmm. And as far as states go, New Mexico might have the most interesting history of any state, because it's basically the Kazakhstan of the U.S. It's the frontier where you have two empires, the American and the Spanish, meeting, plus a large number of other groups, the Comanches, the Navajos, the Apaches, the Pueblos, all of whom are in violent conflict with each other for quite a long time. So you've got, the Spanish conquest, and then you've got there's an indigenous revolution that is successful for 13 years in 1680, and the Spanish come back. And the Spanish are at war with the Comanches, and then the Apaches are at war with the Comanches. And then you have the Americans come in, the Mexican after the Mexican Revolution, the Mexican American War. And then you have the Civil War, and you have the Wild West with Billy the Kid in Lincoln County Wars, right? So it's as far as like history that would appeal to like when I was 12 years old, right? You got cowboys and Indians. You got the Civil War. You got all of these political military conflicts. It'd be fascinating, right? The kids had no interest whatsoever in any of it. They just did not care one iota.
As a Gen Xer, I was kind of there. I was kind of there too. Not really interested at the time. And then maybe it's just something that you learn. As you start to realize that you remember kind of a country that the people around you don't remember, right? Like when you're not the youngest guy in the room, I think people maybe get nostalgic for times that weren't really worth being nostalgic for. That's kind of an ongoing meme, by the way, but
but I mean, the subject matter,
appreciate history later,
subject,
you know,
matter, like, was interesting. I mean,
yeah, we appreciate
how can
it later.
You not be interested in the Civil War. It's almost the generational gap is like almost too alien for me. I mean, to understand, how can you not be interested
it's
in
pretty
the
wild.
Late, you yeah. know, military conflicts? They're fascinating.
I grew up around, I mean, I guess I was around some kids that wouldn't even talk to people, right? And their parents made excuses for them. Like, he's got a problem. He's on a spectrum. He's got a disease. You know, he's got a doctor, medicine, but he's got a problem paying attention the idea of somebody teaching you now is kind of a foreign concept.
I will tell you one of the things that, tiny bright spot. So this wasn't the best pupil I had, white kid, but he wasn't bad in any way. But one time I'm going around the class to make sure kids aren't playing video games and doing stuff they're not supposed to, right? And he's reading a book on the Bataan Death March. So I didn't bother him. I'm not supposed to be doing that. But he's reading a book, and it's on a legitimate historical subject, even though it's not what I'm teaching right now. That's more power to him. I'm just going to let him do it.
That's awesome. I think that's awesome, and I think this any kind of spark in a historical curiosity is definitely needs to be fed. And I'm for people being smarter and better and knowing a little bit more of history, including their own. Where possible. So I appreciate the work that you do, and I appreciate that you took the time to come on our show tonight. And even though we still got a few minutes before it's over, you've put in a hard 2 hours here. I told people, I was like, I'm not going to ask him a bunch of questions and grill him on a bunch of stuff. And then that's exactly what I ended up doing, just because it's so interesting to kind of to ask questions to somebody who knows answers. But what can we do to avoid the problems of the past? This is just a way big philosophical question. Probably none of us are qualified to answer it. But, how can we just how can we, what can we do today to make our chances, or, you know, just make tomorrow a little bit better? And how can we avoid slipping into some of the pitfalls of the past? You know, and I think there's no better person could answer that than a historian, right? Like, nobody knows better than them.
I'm not exactly sure. I mean, if I had that answer, I probably
don't go to college, right?
Probably would have
yeah,
been in a better position. I mean, honestly, I'm not, you know, like a lot of historical scholars, my knowledge kind of like drops off a cliff after about, I don't know, 1990 or so, like when I turned 20 or so. So when I play pub trivia, I always lose because I don't know any of the bands or movies or television shows that came, you know, in the 21st century. It's like completely new to me. I mean, who's Beyonce? What do you mean she's like the most popular singer and won the most Grammys? What are you talking about?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I kind of checked out on pop culture, like, as soon as I found out there was such a thing. And I don't think that's really abnormal, but I think it's kind of funny that we checked out about the same time. It sounds like they're right about the end of the 90s, the early 2000s. The culture just it was already nuts. And what's crazy to me is I didn't even see the anti-white thing coming up. I didn't see any of that. I didn't understand the Russian that was telling us about the spies that were here in the 80s, Bezmenov. I didn't understand any of this kind of, you know, neo-communist institutional march. This was all alien to me until one day I realized that Don Lemon just said that, you know, that white guys are the most dangerous people on earth. And I just thought, what a weird thing for that guy to say about a whole group of people. You know, it's just like, it was the first experience of racism as a white person that you actually noticed, even though it's been happening for years. And, you know, Breitbart had been talking about it for at least a decade. You know, he talked about it before. But I didn't notice any of that stuff because, like you said, you're kind of busy just going to work every day. And, you know, you're more interested in the, like, the price of groceries than you are national politics. And I think that's life for most people.
Yeah. I will say, I don't know if I'm oblivious because I'm older, but I didn't experience personally any anti-white sentiment until I went overseas. So I lived in three non-white countries for a total of 12 years. I didn't experience a whole lot of it, but I did experience some in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. And of course, the difference in those places is like I was the only white guy, you know, the very small minority, nobody to protect you.
Yeah. I imagine you're not the kind of place where you're like, oh, we'll show that, you know, oh, what? We'll show them. Yeah, it's kind of weird here. Like there was kind of a boomer kind of patriotism that gets offended when you realize like your country, you know, there's not a fight coming. You already lost it. You already lost the battle. You lost the battle for your culture and your country 100 years ago. And people have forgotten since then. Like, it's kind of funny. I kind of go through, I feel like this idea of as just getting smarter as time goes on. But I think the numbers and the deltas probably go the other direction, right? We're getting a little dumber as time goes on. When I read books from, you know, when I read Henry Ford, when I read, you know, somebody from the pre-World War II, they're much more eloquent, they're more well-spoken, they're much better at, you know, arranging complex thoughts. Their books actually are, you know, interesting and chewy, and it's not just cultural blather and, you know, degeneracy. It seems like we've kind of, you know, we're way past the Enlightenment now, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, I said, I'm not sure what to do with most of the younger generation. So I guess we'd be talking people who are Zoomers at this point, or at least the younger ones, as far as sparking any interest in their own past and history. It's, I said, even the most interesting parts seem to be something that they don't care about. I suppose, in one sense, it's a good double-edged sword in that They don't care about the propaganda and the fake mythology as well. But you know, it's still shocking to me as a Gen X guy that nobody under 40, you know, cares about the history of Western civilization, basically.
No, it's you're not wrong. That's kind of the black cloud that's kind of, you know, over everybody's head. But it's something that we kind of make jokes about it, right? But we still get up every day. I still get up every day, and you know, I still have an interest in telling people something that they don't know, especially if they can use that information to maybe put themselves in a better position. You know, that's kind of the big, you know, that's the big hope. But in a lot of cases, maybe it's just, maybe we're just going through the motions, but at least there's something to do, right? Like something to do. I think we'll take that, though. We'll take what we can get for white pills. And people will become interested. I think it's just, it's kind of, it's, maybe it's a white thing. Maybe it's not racial, but we become interested in losing things after they're gone, sadly. It just seems to be.
Right. But my point was that generationally, younger whites seem to have lost, as I said, the interest in their own history. That is, you know, when you talk about European history or the history of white settlers coming into the American Southwest, talk about the Civil War, where you basically had two white armies fighting in an area that that still had, and even does today, a large non-white population. They don't care. So I find that kind of disconcerting. So, I mean, this is not something that has anything to do with non-whites. This is something to do with the failure of white people to pass on successfully an interest in their own history and heritage to the next generation.
Well, I mean, that's a hell of a thing to bring up at the end of the show. But it's but you're right. You're right, and I think that's what we should have kind of led in with. You know, but essentially is that there is an alarming disinterest in our own culture by our own people. I don't know if it's from the breakdown of the family. Like I remember, I learned reverence for you know, for tradition from my dad and my grandfathers. You know, maybe the kids these days don't have those connections. Maybe, you know, more broken families means more kids that are out of touch with that that kind of idea. Conservatism's been taken over and replaced by some weird Jews in a skin suit, and you know, really, there's a lot of people that are politically homeless and they don't really have much of an identity anymore in their own country. But I think that as long as we can talk about it, you know, maybe. You know, maybe it at least won't be forgotten that it existed. Maybe we can do something about it too. Just to throw that out there, guys. You know, but it's just like the show, man. You know, sometimes there's 300 people really interested in hearing you just call people words, you know, names, and sometimes you'll get a really awesome guest on, and 50 people will show up and something that blows their mind. And I'm fine with that. I'm fine with the latter, actually. Because, you know, the cheap stuff is cheap, right? But, like, how many opportunities do you get to sit down with Otto and ask him questions? So thanks for coming on my show. And hopefully we can do this again and maybe work on stuff in the future. But I'm kind of always around and just kind of skulking around and on Telegram and doing this show every day. And always interested in talking to big brain people, and especially if they can shine a light on something that's slowly being forgotten or, you know, overlooked, or, you know, just to me, that stuff's interesting. I we're a minority, but there's still some of us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It was great to guys, talk to you. And yeah, I'm sure we can do it again in the future.
Follow Otto on Twitter, right? Are you anywhere else other than Twitter?
Well, my academic EDU site, I do have the YouTube channel still up, but I just haven't updated it. I think the last video I did was on ethnic Germans in Romania, in the Banat and Transylvania. That was, I don't know, maybe even a couple of years ago, but I've got a number of them up there still. I have more that I privatized when I went to work in the school district here briefly before resigning. So I may put some of those back up, but I do have a few interesting ones. I think my best one, which had the most viewers, is a discussion of the historical strike with Ernst Nolte and how it translates into American historiography. That seemed to have been the one that had the most views.
You translate the 1907 protocols, you're going to have all the views you want.
Well, I have to read it and translate it first, because right now I have no idea.
I'm just telling you a little inside, just a little inside stuff there. But if you're the guy that makes the English translation of the Znamia protocols of Zion, I think that's actually historic. You'd be doing something historic, and
I don't know. Has anybody ever become famous translating?
No, probably not. But damn that! I mean, like, that's pretty base, though. To find any discrepancies between the known first version and what will become the new known first version, right? Yeah, I don't know if that's ever going to be officially acknowledged. I mean, you'd probably have a better idea than I could, but
we'll have to see. But I have to start it before I can finish it. So at the moment, that project hasn't actually gotten underway yet. But
right on. Just hide. Just hide. Run and hide. Yeah. Go into a cave. Don't tell anybody where you're at, and then it's a forgery. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the translating, I'm not going to get into any of the
it's a forgery.
History of it. I'm just going to translate the first version here. Other people can make the evaluation, but I will render it from Russian to English.
That's the right way to do it. I agree. I think you're doing the right thing. And you're a smart guy, and I'd have to have you back on the show sometime. And I'll keep in touch with you. And
all right.
And I'm going to get your YouTube channel from you, too, in DMs. That way I can watch your videos.
All right. Well, thanks, Otto, for joining us tonight. If anybody else has a show that'd like to have me on, I'm available, although my schedule keeps changing. But we made this one work for me, despite being a Saturday night.
We try to make it easy, and you made it really easy to talk to you. So thanks again. And guys, catch up with Otto on Twitter. DM him if you want him for your show there, Night Nation, if you want him, Nick. And thank you again, J. Otto Pohl, right?
Yes.
We'll see you next time on the flood, on the Doom Depot, sir.
Thank you very much.
All right, I got to find the button to get rid of this guy. Get him out of here. Thanks again, Otto. Yeah. What a nice guy, and what a cool guest to have on the show. What a fantastic guest. I enjoy talking to these guys. I know that I sound stupid to them. I know that I probably, come off as probably a bit arrogant, but I am interested in what these folks have to say. I'm interested in the books they've written, and I hope that you are too. And I hope that you'll check out his website. I'll give you guys this link again, and I'll make sure that the links are in all the descriptions. But The Years of Gray Silence, right? This is we often talk about, atrocities that happen to Germans. We often talk about some of the more well-known things like the Rhine Meadows and things like that. But it's very important to kind of also, keep an open ear for the, those echoes from the past, right? That that maybe nobody heard right at the time. So check out his work. And if you're interested, buy his book, it would help him out. And I'm sure that it'd help out his publisher too. It's probably wants to lean on him to pay some bills eventually. And let's see, that's his Columbia. That's the book. Let me get his academia address, and I'll put that link in the chats as well. And say thank you guys for hanging out with me tonight. It's been a Saturday night, which a Saturday night big brain show. They said it couldn't be done, but we did it, and I still enjoy thoughtful conversation and learning things I didn't know. Even if I am a little stupid, I am totally fine with that. I'm just really glad people will still come talk to us and enjoy our show and hang out. Yo, we're getting a donation from somebody. That's crazy. what's happening here. Shout out to Krieger.
/WFP.
Thank you, Krieger. Very kind of you to say, sir. Made my parrot dance right there. Look at him dancing. Let me make sure here. Now I got to switch this audio back. Hopefully we won't get this echo again. But I want to say thanks again if you're out there. Thank you, Otto. And let me, I'll kill off this stream feed too. No, I need that here. I got to bring this back in. I may not be able to. I may have to dump this. Actually, let me do that. Now I'll try to get that back. See, one cool thing about being in a dashboard is if your stream dumps, you're still online. You're still online. See? Pretty cool. Now, I'm probably just pulling it back in just to say, you know, wrap it up and good night. But may as well do it anyway, just since it's the first time. Right? First time in our new house, we get to use the garage. Dang, my voice is a little cooked. What's tomorrow? Sunday? Day off. See you at 4. Put this in here and we'll save it. And this should bring us back in. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, we're back. And hey, you can see the screen now. Yay. Okay, we win. Now mute this and unmute these and we're back. That's amazing. Okay. These, and we're back. That's amazing.
Success.
Okay. We had a success, right? Successful Big Brain show on a Saturday success. Night. Thank you again, Krieger 88. Right?
Successful Big Brain show.
Thank you to everybody who
on a
came
Saturday
out here.
Thanks
thank
to
you
again, Krieger 88.
Everybody that came out.
Thank you to everybody who came out here.
Thanks to everybody that shared the links. Everybody that came out.
Big Brains, come on,
to check out what Otto's about and
come on.
Bring him on.
Big Brains,
come on.
Shout out
to Whitefire. He gave us
1,000 bolts.
Come on. Bring him on. Shout out to Whitefire. He gave us 1,000
bolts. You guys are very generous. You know, just kind of a hangout and chat stream.
You guys are very very generous for
you know,
just kind of a hangout and chat stream.
Thank you so much.
But thank you so much. Thank you so much, White Fire. Thank you so much. Thank you very much to Night Nation Review, right, for being incredibly based. Thank you very much to Night Nation Review, right, for being incredibly based.
Now, Carl, too, you definitely should have Carl and Otto, too.
Yes, and you should try to get them both on at the same time.
Carl, too, you definitely should have Carl and Otto on your show.
And you should try to get them both on at the same time. I think that'd be a hoot.
Then again, I think a lot of things are funny that aren't funny at all.
But no, it's nice to get. It's nice to do these big brain shows. We're always out there to do more. If you're out there,
but
you're
no,
a big
nice brain.
It's nice to do these big brain
you
shows. We're always out there to
hang
do more.
Out.
If you're out there, you're a big brain.
You want to come
straight
on this show
Nazi
and just hang
shit.
Out and just talk
no,
about,
no.
You know.
See, we're not really
straight
even that anti-Semitic.
Shit.
We're not even that hateful.
See,
we're not really even that anti-Semitic. We're not even that hateful.
Just here
to use the laugh track, right?
And
but just here to use the laugh track, right? And
because.
And for the 14
we have
words,
to secure the
right?
existence
because,
of our people,
and the future for your children.
We have to secure right? the existence of
I
our
don't
people,
have any.
And the future for
yet.
Your children.
Yeah, if you're out right. there, ladies,
I don't have any
yet. Yeah, if you're out there, ladies,
wow.
don't hit my telegram.
Wow.
Don't do it.
Wow.
Okay,
don't hit my telegram
out of here. Okay, we're gonna play a song on the way out of here. Oh, this one always gets me in the feels. Oh, this one always gets me in the feels.
Start to crackle in the heat.
be still as the stars fall from the sky. Breathe in as sunlight fills it all.
Yeah, if you like this show, catch us next Tuesday.
Yeah, if you like this show, catch us next Tuesday.
Tuesday night.
We're going to have David Duke on the show next Tuesday.
Same time.
Tuesday night, 7 to 11.
Tuesday night.
Dr. David Duke.
Same time, 7 to 11.
Dr. David Duke.
Praise Hitler. Praise Hitler. Praise Hitler.